Hi guys, and welcome back to the Connect You podcast. Today I'm here with Victoria from SPM Property. She's a mum of three and a property entrepreneur and a true inspiration to anyone that wants to get started in property. So Victoria, welcome to the podcast.
Hello Lewis, thank you for having me.
That's all right. So I always start these podcasts in the same way. Take me back to when you first started. What was it like for you growing up in South London?
So yeah, I grew up in South East London with my mum, my dad and my sister. It was, well, I think it was a very ordinary childhood. You know, there was the four of us. We lived in our little council house. Mum and dad went to work. Me and my sister argued more days than we probably didn't. Yeah. But yeah, it was just, I've said to other people before, quite often when you listen to people on podcasts or listen to them on stage, they've got like these stories of like truly dark moments. And for me, I just think I'm quite ordinary. It was just an ordinary upbringing.
So you lived on a council estate, South East London.
Yeah.
Is that what drove you to invest in property or?
No, honestly, I really didn't have that much interest in property. My husband did. And one night he went out and I thought he was at a networking event promoting his locksmith business. And then okay. He came back and he was showing me some bits and pieces he'd picked up. And I came across an invoice for £1,000. And I was like, so tell me where you've been again.
Yeah.
And he signed us up to a property education weekend. And I went into that weekend thinking perhaps if we could get a house for each of the kids as like a little inheritance, that would be great. And when I had my eyes open to just what you can do with property, I was like pinky in the brain. I was ready to take over the world. So I was like, let's go.
Right, okay. And see, growing up, tell me what it was like growing up on the streets of South East London, because I know that you didn't have it as easy as you're making out.
Well, it was fine. It was a lovely little street and predominantly all council houses. There was a few that were privately owned, but up and down that street, I knew that I could knock on any neighbour's door. Mm. I'd be welcomed in, I'd be fed, I'd be watered. There was a bunch of us that used to go out and play from, I don't know, 9 o'clock in the morning, something like that, until kind of your mum called you in for tea. And it was a council estate, but it was, I think, quite an idyllic childhood. I got to go out and play, you know, we didn't have buckets of money, I didn't go on expensive holidays, we didn't have designer clothes. It was just an ordinary upbringing, but for me, I look back on it with great memories, because it was just lots of fun.
And what was your family life like?
That was fairly normal. You know, my mum and dad went to work, and me and my sister went to school. My sister's 6.5 years older than me, so there's a fair age difference. By the time I was kind of just starting secondary school, she'd met who was going to be her husband, and she was ready to move out and settle down. But yeah, just like I say, nothing special.
Because you've told me that your mum and your dad suffered with illness, didn't they?
Forgot about that bit, sorry. it's so ordinary to me that I kind of forget, yeah. So both my parents are disabled. They suffer with a type of dwarfism called achondroplasia, which means their arms and their legs are a lot shorter than everybody else's. So at 5'2", I was the tallest person in the house, which when you come out in the big world isn't really that great. But I grew up with them with their disability. It meant helping them with certain things. So it was always me up in the loft, or me changing the light bulbs, or changing the clocks when the clocks change. But so there was an element of caring, but it was what it was, really.
How was that at school? How did that impact you at school?
People had quite a lot to say about it. My sister resorted to punching them in the face. That's how she coped with it. But I've never liked confrontation. So for me, if they came up and went, "Hey, your mum's only little," I'd just go, "Yeah, I know." And I found the bullies just backed off, because you can't respond to that. If someone just goes, "Yeah, I know," and doesn't rise to it, there's then no comeback for them. So I found that the easiest way. And it wasn't because I was trying to be clever. It wasn't because I was trying to be brave. It's just I don't like confrontation. So I found that the easiest way to disperse it.
So you've always, from that, cared for your parents, and then obviously you've helped your sister as well by saying that this is the easiest way to transition out of the confrontation side.
She's always had a bit of an issue with coping with her disability, I think, whereas like I say, I just found that the easiest way to disperse it. And then as we've grown up, obviously I've kind of cared for them a bit more and a bit more. Mum's now in a mobility scooter all the time. She's lost the use of her legs. So again, there's a bit more caring involved, but you do what you do, don't you? You just
Absolutely.
Look after them.
That's what you've got to do now. And then you haven't touched on this part as well, but people that don't know, you've actually, You was a vet. You started to be a vet as well.
Yeah. So from about the age of 5 or 6, I wanted to work in a vets, and that was always my passion. And I left school, became a veterinary nurse. Mm-hmm. So I think helping people, I think I've discovered, and kindness is one of my kind of my core values. So yeah, left school, became a veterinary nurse, qualified as veterinary nurse, became a head nurse, and managed, I think it was 24 practices across Essex and London at one point.
24?
Yeah, for a group that had 24 practices across Essex and London. So that was quite busy.
Where do you think you get the drive from to do that?
I always found that a bit of a tricky one. I think it's because, like I said, we never had a lot as kids. I had a mm-hmm. great childhood, but we never had a lot. And moving forward, I want freedom from the constraints for 9 to 5. I want freedom for my kids. If we decide on Friday night we want to go to Centre Parks for the weekend, I want to be able to just book it. If I decide next week let's fly off to Greece for a week, I want to be able to do it. I don't want to have to worry about where the money's coming from. I don't want to have to worry that my kids are going to be trapped in a 9 to 5 job making someone else richer. So I think it comes from, you always want better, I think, for your kids generally than what you had. And I think if you look at every generation does have slightly more than their parents had. But for me, it's predominantly about having a freedom.
And then the time, as like you touched on briefly earlier, is to look after your parents.
Yeah. And like mum had a knee replacement 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And there was a 9-month wait for a knee replacement. And it was £10,000 if you'd got it done privately. And I wished with all the might in the world that I could have just gone, there you go, mum, there's 10 grand, go get your knee done. And it wouldn't have been an option. It wouldn't have been an issue to be able to pay for it. That's the kind of thing that I want to be able to do.
So take me back to when you was a nurse. What sort of struggles did you have during that period?
Probably the biggest one was when I slipped a couple of discs in my lumbar spine. So like I say, worked for too many years. I won't tell you how many because that'll age me. So worked for a long time as a veterinary nurse. Stopped briefly when I had my first daughter and then went to work for an emergency clinic. So I was senior nurse. And out of hours at work nights and weekends, and we had a Great Dane that needed some emergency surgery, and on the second time of lifting that onto the examination table I slipped 2 discs in my spine, which has impacted my life ever since. That was 12 years ago. It's put me in hospital a few times. I've had several steroid injections. I've had my right leg electrically denervated, so my sciatic nerve in my right leg doesn't work anymore, which stopped the pain, which was great.
So how has that impacted your everyday life?
When they go, I can't drive, I can't walk. When my youngest daughter, who's nearly 6, was a baby, it was really bad. They went in the July and then they went again in January. And when she fell over or when she was upset, she would run past me to somebody else because she knew I couldn't pick her up. And as a mum, that's heartbreaking to watch your daughter run past you to someone else to pick her up. That completely did me. And in January 2019, I ended up in hospital for about 8-9 days, because it was so bad. I couldn't walk, couldn't drive, like I say, couldn't do anything. So ended up in hospital for over a week.
How did you deal with it?
How did I deal with it? I was on some pretty hefty drugs while I was in there. It was fine. But then as I came out, they kept telling me it was all psychological. All my pain was psychological. And it made me feel like I was slightly crazy. And I didn't like that feeling. But then I had a great physio who said to me, it is all psychological, but you can't control it. Your brain is sending out pain signals that you have no control over. So don't stress on that bit. And they kept telling me not to be afraid to exercise. But when you've had, like I say, 9 days in hospital and it's been a recurring thing over many years, you're terrified to exercise because anything that makes your back kind of wince slightly is like, I'm not doing that. I'm not brave enough to put myself back there. But he said, you've just got to kind of retrain your brain and you've just kind of got to keep moving. And you can do anything you want. I was like, seriously? And a lot of my friends at that point were doing the couch to 5K. And I was like, can I do that? And before that, I'd only ever run a bath. I was not built for running. And he went, yeah, if you want to. So I worked my way up through the exercises the physio gave me and then started the couch to 5K. And I literally, running for a minute, killed me. I was like puffing, I was red, not attractive, sweaty mess. and I remember about week 6, you go from running for 8 minutes to 20 minutes. I was like, not in your life. There is no way I can run for over double what I'm running already. And I had a really bad habit of flicking to the week ahead. And I looked the week ahead and I was like, 20 minutes. There's no way I can run for 20 minutes at the end of next week. No, and I just kept thinking about it. I was like, 20 minutes? I can't run for 20 minutes. I can't run for 8 at the minute. And then I kind of thought about it and I thought, but they wouldn't put it at that point in the programme if everybody stopped. If everybody gave up and went, I can't do it, they would move 20 minutes further down the programme. So I kind of was like, maybe it's possible then, maybe you can do it. So kind of flip the mindset, and I'm a big believer in positive mindset, but flip the mindset around, I was like, okay, let's give it a whirl, see how far we get. And I did it, and I came home so elated that I'd managed to run for 20 minutes. It was a real, real achievement. And then finished the Couch to 5K. Then it dinged up, why not try 10K? So I was like, yeah, okay, why not? So I did a 10K. That led on to a half marathon where I raised, I think it was £700 for dementia and about £300 for Teenage Cancer Trust, and entered a charity race to help some a women's refuge as well. And then I decided I'd set my sights on the marathon. So in October last year, I completed the virtual London Marathon and raised, I think it was about £1,500 for Dementia UK. So, over the moon that I've gone from 9 days in hospital to completing a marathon. And next year, my sights are set on an ultra, 50 miles. Here I come.
That's absolutely amazing. I think anyone that's listening will need to reach out to you and say congratulations from not being able to move, not being able to pick your daughter up, to now doing an ultra.
Yeah, and I almost forget about the backstory sometimes, and I'll say to people, oh yeah, I ran the marathon in October, which obviously is an achievement in itself. I think there's something like 1% of people have run a marathon.
Yeah.
But then my husband always says to me, but you need to put the backstory on that, Vic. You need to kind of tell people where you've come from. And it's, like I say, because it's me, and I downplay me a lot, I'll tell you I'm very ordinary and quite boring.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of forget that in 2019, I literally, like I say, hospitalised for 9 days. I was being pushed around in a wheelchair because my legs just weren't working. And then, like I say, next year I'm planning to run 50 miles. So, yeah. I think it just kind of thing that if I can do it from there, then anyone can manage it, surely.
And this is the point of this whole podcast, and obviously people watching on YouTube will get to see what from where you've come from and get to see that you was, say, bedbound, you was on a lot of drugs from what you said.
Yeah, they were great.
And now you're going to be running an ultra. You've completed a marathon, you've done the Couch to 5K, then you've done the 20K, then you've done a marathon, and now you're going to be doing an ultra. So what was you telling yourself when you was doing them things, when you was doing the 5K, when you was doing the 20K, then doing the marathon, to get you through them hard times?
I like a programme. I like something that sets me out that you've got to run this many miles on this day, and then you've got to run this many miles on this day.
Mm.
And I think, I liked the training programme. I liked knowing how far I had to run and when. I do like something to follow. But I think ultimately the bit that pushed me was the reason I run for dementia was my nan had dementia.
Okay.
Me and my nan were very, very close. Some of my fondest memories are in my nan's house, playing with her button tin, watching her draw ballerinas, cooking, all that kind of thing. As I'm sure many people love spending time with their grandparents. And then she developed dementia. And it got to the point, I remember the day clearly, that I went in and I said hello to her and she just looked through me and she didn't know who I was. And that absolutely, again, it's another kind of heartbreaking moment. And I felt so upset when I come out. Mum said to me, don't go and see her anymore then. I said, she's my nan. I can't not go and see her, can I? But when I turn up, she'd normally just be kind of staring into space. And I'd say, hi, Nan. And she'd give me a full-on beaming smile. And the day that I turned up and she didn't, it was so sad. And then I think she was only with us for about 6 months after that. But if I can stop one other person going through that experience where a loved one doesn't recognise them, then I'll run all the miles that I need to. So it's helping people with dementia and helping their families that pushes me through those hard times.
And I think you're going to do an amazing job.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. So fast forward to obviously investing in property.
Yep.
What I know you've said that your husband
he
signed you up for a program.
Yeah, so it was a property education.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
So, like I say, he went along to this evening, and I thought it was a networking event. Like I say, he ran a locksmith business, yeah. And I thought he was going to promote that. And then he came home having spent some money, and I took it a bit more seriously. So we went along to the weekend, and they kind of give you a taster of all the different ways there are to buy property and how you can make it work and how you can kind of recycle your money. So if you can buy at the right price, then you can refinance it and take your money out and go again you well know. But then I came across a strategy for supported living. So it's helping people like prison leavers, homeless people, kids that have reached 16 and are no longer part of the care system, asylum seekers, all those kinds of vulnerable people. And I just, again, going back to that whole kind of kindness and helping people thing, it completely fits with my core values. So 75% of our portfolio now is out supported living, and it's helping vulnerable people. And it, I like the fact that I can help people, but I'm also running a successful business through it. I'm making money to fund a lifestyle that I want for my family. So for me, everyone's winning. And I think one of the best parts of it, the first people that we housed in one of our properties was a young lady and two kids, and it was about 10 days before Christmas, and they turned up with nothing, just literally kind of a suitcase full of clothes. So I said to my managing agent, I want to buy them a Christmas tree. And he was like, what? I was like, the kids haven't got a Christmas tree. So I ordered one online, they picked it up, and apparently she just broke down in tears and like was hugging the guy that dropped it off. So for 30 quid or whatever it cost me, it made her Christmas. And I think stories like that just are the reason that people should get involved and the reason that you should invest in supported living.
And how do they?
How do they?
From when you first started, how long has it taken you to get to where you are now, and how do people get started in supported living?
So we've been investing for about 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. And I think education is key. You need to understand what you're doing. Investing in any shape or form is risky. And I'm not FCA regulated, so this isn't advice, it's just my opinion. But yeah, any kind of investment is risky. We all know that. Mm-hmm. And I think you need to be as educated as you can be to mitigate as many risks as possible. So understand how to invest in property, educate yourself, and then for me, it's contacting providers and finding what it is that providers want. So we had a lady contact us recently, and she's got a 5-bed house that's been being used as SA, and now the serviced accommodation bubble is starting to slow. She now wants to put it somewhere else. And she's like, I've got this, I want to put it out to a provider. And it's not always that simple. It's not necessarily the right kind of property for the providers in her area. So you need to contact the providers, you need to understand what it is that they're looking for. Are they looking for 1-bedroom flats? Are they looking for 5-bed HMOs? What are they? What is it that they're looking for? And then you can find the right kind of property for them. And it's about, I know we had a conversation earlier, but it's about building relationships. So getting to know the providers, building the relationship, understanding what it is that they want, and then finding properties that suit their requirements.
So anyone that does want to get into supported living and obviously house the homeless, asylum seekers, and pretty much anyone that's in a vulnerable situation, can they reach out to you for any advice? So they can always reach out to me. I'm more than happy to help them. But I'm in no means an expert, because I've not actually done that strategy or implemented that strategy in my portfolio as of yet, but could they reach out to you?
Yeah, of course, yeah. I'm happy to share with you.
Perfect.
Email address, that kind of thing, and they can reach out Facebook, however they want to contact.
Perfect. So what's next for you?
Apart from the ultra.
Yeah, apart from the ultra.
So to continue to grow my portfolio, my aim is to get it to over £1 million. So we're on the way, we're not there yet. To continue with my supported living, to try and spread the word about supporting living as much as possible, because like I say, from an investment point of view, it makes sense, and from an ethical point of view, it makes sense. So I don't understand why more people don't do it. To increase my portfolio, we're looking at some commercial stuff as well, potentially some commercial to residential conversions.
And what about personally? I know you're doing the ultra, but personally, What's the end goal for yourself? Obviously, I know you've got the ultra, but is there ever an end in line? What does that look like to you?
I was thinking about this morning, funnily enough. I guess I'm not very good at looking back and recognising what I've achieved. I kind of tick it off and then move on to the next thing. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's being in a position where finance isn't an issue, and like I say, we have the freedom to go or to do whatever it is that we want. So I'm guessing when I get there, it probably won't quite be enough and I want to move on to the next thing. But at the moment, yeah, it's being in a position where I've gone from being that ordinary girl that grew up in a council house to being someone who can just say yes to anything and not have to consider what it's going to cost me.
So just a recap, you've gone from the girl in South London, the ordinary girl who you still class yourself as, that's now, well, essentially an ordinary girl in South London that's gone on to be a veterinary nurse looking after 24 practices,
yeah,
to then injuring yourself, bedbound, running a 5K, 20K, 10K, 20K, marathon, now an ultra, potentially.
Yeah.
Well, you will do. I have no doubt about that. To growing a portfolio.
Yeah.
And you still class yourself as ordinary. You're not. You're an inspiration.
Thank you very much.
You That's are an inspiration. Really kind of you to say. You're not ordinary. I can promise you that. There's very few people that will do it.
And like you say, when you kind of, if you look at it, in the fact that you've gone from being in hospital to running a marathon, that's without sounding big-headed, that is pretty cool. But it was just, to me, it is what it is, you know? I spent a week in hospital and I'm out and I'm fine. So it wasn't a big deal. Well, isn't a big deal now, wasn't.
It's not necessarily to yourself, but that, what you said there, will change someone's life, how you've done it, what inspired you to do it, because I can certainly relate to you, because when I come out of hospital, or during when I went in to have my leg or my ankle fused, I've done exactly the same thing. I come out, I've essentially, what I've done is done exactly what you've done, got the weights out, stayed healthy, stayed fit for the recovery purpose. I was like, oh, my head is, I'm just being focused, laser focused to get recovered so I can be healthier, stronger, fitter for the kids, get back into work, get back into the business. But if, to me, that was the norm, but for anyone else, would be like, don't need to do it.
No.
But to put that, to articulate that to someone else, why? They're like, well, that's not the norm. Very hard for other people to understand that. But when you're that driven, you've got to do it for the right reason for your kids.
Yeah. And I guess a lot of people now, I think where we've got such instant gratification, it's, they want the quick and the easy path, don't they? Mm. They want to be a millionaire overnight. They want the quick fix. Everything is about having a result easily and instantly, isn't it?
Mm.
And I think from what I've been told through my coaches, is anything that's worth having, you have to work for, and it takes time. Mm. And I think I'm starting to realise that is quite true. And the longer and the harder you work for it, the more rewarding it is when you finally get it. And I just think a lot of people, because they can have everything now, like with Amazon, you can have it, well, unless you live where I live, you can have it the same day. It always says same day delivery, and then it's like, yeah, that'll arrive in 3 days. But it's all easy and it's all quick. And I think a lot of people have lost that kind of drive to work for stuff and to take the time and the dedication to put into it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's my personal opinion.
No, it is. Everything's like, you can have it now.
Mm.
I mean, I completely agree with that. But you can see there's a trend, like you mentioned with service accommodation, there's a trend of people now just going, yeah, I'm going to slowly veer off from that. Even in property, in business, in whatever it is, people are lazy.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Fitness.
A few months ago, Molly May from Love Island was criticised because she was interviewed by Stephen Bartlett. And yeah, she said that she'd reached the success she'd reached more than the other contestants because she'd put the hard work in. And she basically said, if you're willing to work hard, you can have whatever you want. Yeah. And she was absolutely slated for it. And I was just like, but it's true though.
She yes.
If you put the effort in and you work hard, you'll get, not necessarily in a 9-to-5 job, but if you're willing to put the effort in, you'll get results, won't you?
In her field, she's probably one of the best.
Yeah.
But that's all you need to be in your industry, in your niche. That's all you need to do. And that's why I said, I've not done it. And it does align with what I want to do. But at the minute, obviously, my business is doing all right. So once that's done and it's finished and it's parked, I'll park that to one side. I will move over and have a go. And the first person we're going to is yourself. And that's what I'll do, is when that business is done, we go to you, then we can have a look at it. But it's, you're so right in what you're saying. People just go instant gratification. Now we move on to the next thing.
Mm.
And Amazon FBA. You see it all the time on social media. 10k in 90 days. It's bollocks. It doesn't fucking work.
Or you're going to end up as 25 grand poorer because you've paid that muppet over there who's telling you you're going to be 10 grand richer in three months.
Yeah. Well, you might get 10 grand in 90 days, but try and get that consistently.
Yeah.
Like, this is fucking hard work now. But again, I might be a bit brutal with people. But again, that's why people come back and they go, well, it comes back to them building relationships.
But it's honest though, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you're honest and you're straight. And what is the point in dressing it up? If it's not going to work, it's not going
to
work.
No. Again, that's why people, like we said earlier, people want me to go and speak with them because I'm not going to beat around the bush, not going to tell you shit. Because this is what you're going to get and this is what you've got to pay. If you don't do the work in the middle, you're not going to get either of them.
No.
So, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you can see the hard work that you've put in, and as a result of that, that's why you started there and you're now here. And it doesn't go unnoticed, especially from someone like myself who's trod a similar path. But yeah, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to watch your journey. I really can't.
Thank you very brilliant. Much.
Hopefully I'll be a part of it sometime.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
Brilliant. I mean, thank you so much. Honestly, you are an inspiration, and don't sell yourself short.
Thank you.
Really don't.
I am. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I just don't. I'm just me. I don't know. I'm just me. And like when we took over the networking business, the couple, when we were out for dinner with them, and they said to us, like, we're looking at stepping away from IMN, and we thought of you and Glenn to take it over. And it was one of almost the moments where I was like, who they're talking to then? It's not me. And they were like, we think you'd be a great fit. And I've, like you, never done any speaking, any public speaking. I've been interviewed now. I think this is about my fifth podcast, but this is the first one I've done face-to-face. The rest of them have all just been on Zoom. So it's not been, I don't know, it's been a bit easier, I guess, because it's just on a computer. But the thought of standing up in front of a room of like 50 people and speaking to them and introducing the speakers, and I was a bit like, I'm not qualified enough for that, not little old me. But yeah, they were like, don't tell you, and again, they were like, don't tell yourself short. And I was just like, okay.
The thing is, like, a buster will push me, because the buster said to me loads of times, to take things, obviously one of my things is it's called the Next Level Property Community. I'm telling people to take it to the next level. I have to.
Yeah.
So things like this. It's easier to do it, like you say, it's easier to do it on Zoom. But really, I've got to be doing it in here. Getting it close, intimate, personal. Not really asking intimate questions as such, but I've got to be there stepping it up.
Mm-hmm.
My game's got to be stepped up. Why? Because I've got to lead by example.
Yeah, completely.
Kids, my community, friends, family, everyone. I've got to be the one leading by example. And I'm not the one that goes, you can have fucking 100 grand in 90 days or whatever they say you can have. But again, it comes back to building relationships. If I'm not doing what I'm saying, the community will leave.
Exactly.
So that's what I do personally. Whether it's here, I'll do it in your home. And that's what I always believe in. If I'm not going to do what I say, you might as well just leave. It's a big world out there with property. But there's very few people that you'll get on with. Very, very few people.
But I think if you make the effort to put yourself around like-minded people, then you'll discover people that are, like you say, willing to work hard and willing to put the effort in. There's a lot of people that stand and talk about it.
Mm.
But if you keep moving, then you'll find other people that are doing the same. And one thing that really surprised me is how willing other people are to help.
Yeah.
You know, how much you can go to someone and go, I'm struggling with this, what do you think? Or, like, I'm not sure about this deal, would you ever look at it for me? And people are just willing to help. And that... Mm-hmm. I kind of thought people would be a bit more kind of protective and a bit more closed off, and not quite as willing to share or to help. But
I think when people reach a certain level, if they're part of certain communities, they'll be advised to charge a certain fee. You know, you go, that's fine if that's the way you are. But again, it comes back to the building relationships. Depends on the type of person you are. If you're going to cut certain people out of your life, that's fine. Me personally, it depends on what. If you brought a deal for me, I'm not going to charge. If I'm getting 10 phone calls a day from that individual, you've got to have a cut off point.
Yeah, exactly.
Most people would be the same. But yeah, there's a massive industry out there, but a very small community that do it well. And that's in the whole, every single strategy, I mean. So you've got service accommodation, BRR flips, whatever it is, there's only a very few people that would actually do it well. We'd probably name on one hand, in all honesty. But because there's so many people now, you can buy it for a pound. Buy a course for a pound, go on it, and then you're an expert. Yeah. That's it. So you've now got a title as a property developer, a property expert. And that's the issue.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the difficulty that we've both got, is that we're trying to go and do the same thing, but we've actually been doing it longer than people that have been doing it 2 minutes, that make our lives a little bit harder, don't they?
Yeah. And go, yeah, it's amazing, come and do this, buy a house for a pound, and you'll make £1 million profit. And it's like,
it's bollocks.
Not really.
It ain't gonna happen.
You'll slug through like 100 viewings, and maybe have 2 accepted. And
yeah.
Then you'll have a refinance that comes in below value.
That's the difficult part.
Yeah.
That's the part I don't understand.
And it is, there's the old phrase that knowledge is power, isn't there? But I think having been involved in property and becoming an entrepreneur, it's nothing to do with the knowledge. It's all about the action. It's great knowing it all, and it's great having all that information, but if you don't go out and put it into practice.
Absolutely. I mean, my clients yesterday, just as an example of that, Andrew and Kate, his ex-army, and he absolutely loves what my client, the service accommodation. It's structured in a way that, because I'm very militant the way I live my life, up at the same time, gym at the same time, just tries to structure my kids in the same way, it doesn't work. But And my program is exactly the same. You can't move on, tick the fucking box, just tick it, so I know you've done it, and I know you've got okay with it, and if you're not, don't tick it and don't fucking move on. But yeah, and he's like, I love this, it's great. 3 properties in 60 days.
Excellent.
And I'm like, what's it netting you? He went, 20 grand. Everyone else is like, I've ticked it, I've watched the video, no, you're not meant to do it. But he's like, it weren't fucking easy. I've made literally this many phone calls. He sent me a list, a spreadsheet over. His wife works for IBM, so very good at data entry. I'm like, yeah, that's about 5 spreadsheets. But you can see he's gone exactly what I said to do. Right, yeah, that's a lot of entries. I went, right, now put it in a group and now you tell everyone else what to do. He went on all the viewings, done exactly what I told him to do. I went, now, everyone copy him because you're obviously not listening to me. And he went, no, we are, we've just not done as many. I went,
well, that's why then.
There you go. 3, how many you got? We've got 1. I went, yeah, but he's winning. And it just comes down to volume. It's a numbers game.
It is completely. I remember the last 2 that we bought, we went and viewed them, and the offers were below the asking price. And then came the agent phoned me up, and he went, those offers you submitted. I was like, yeah, they've been rejected. He went, they've both been accepted. And we had 2 offers going for at the same time. And I was like,
oh, shit.
Right, okay. I phoned my coach, and I was like, we haven't got money to buy the second one, and now we've got 2 more accepted. Like, we've got 4 refurbs to do. And I was like, what do we do? He's like, it'll be fine. And 1 fell out in the middle, and it does all come right, doesn't it? But yeah, when he phoned me, it's like, they've both been, I was just waiting for the rejected bit. And then he went, they've both been accepted. And I was like, right, well, okay.
Yeah, well, me and Joe and Gavin, though, I went, yeah, we've got a bit of a problem. Yeah, we've got a commercial unit coming on board. You know what goes on that unit. We've got this lovely commercial unit on board. I went, and we've got another £400,000 house to find and the money for. And he went, sorry. about 400 grand. He went, what's the refurb? I went, 150. I went, I'll try and get a bit of money off. He went, you're fucking having a laugh. Went, what are you doing? He went, what are we in for? I went, about 500? He went, for fuck's sake. So he went, right, when do we need it? I went, tomorrow. But it's worth a good chunk of money at the end. It's a 7-bed HMO, so I was like, yeah,
but if it's attractive and it stacks, you'll find someone to invest.
It does stack, but we have raised it, which is good. But he's like, for fuck's sake, give me a minute. So we both, me, Joe and Gabby, went away, found the money, and obviously it's gone through. We've got a bit of money off the asking price, and it was just like, we'd never thought that was going to go through in a million years, but it did. But that, I mean, it's taken about a year of viewings to get 4 or 5 now. 5 deals across the line. But people don't realise it.
No.
That's the hard part.
Yeah.
And we've got a spreadsheet of viewings. It's like fucking hundreds. Hundreds of viewings.
Gav's everywhere, isn't he? He's like, yeah. He's probably a little ferret all over.
He's just like, he is. But yeah,
like Roadrunner.
He is. But the thing is, you're putting about 50 grand below. And no, that's fine. I'll be the one that chases it. And eventually we just go like 10 grand, 10 grand, 10, yep. I'm like, take it. But it works. That's why it works well. When you've got someone like me, Gav and Joe that work together. If Gav can't pick it up, I'll pick it up, and then Joe pick it up. That's why it's good to have a team, which is really good, and it works well.
I remember saying to Glenn about a year and a half ago, I was like, I honestly thought we'd be divorced by now, working together. Like, did you? Yeah, I won't lie, yeah. But we're such different people, and we've got such different views on everything, but somehow it brings a balance. I thought it would drive, like, poles apart, but actually it just kind of brings a really good balance. And sometimes when I think he's been a bit too pessimistic and he thinks I'm being a bit too rosy-tinted, one will pull the other back into where they need to be.
It's really interesting. Tell me more about that.
Tell you more about it?
Yeah.
We are very, very different people. He moans that I always go, yeah, it's going to be fine. And I joke that it's like the glass isn't half full, like the glass isn't even there, kind of empty. But that's probably a bit extreme, probably being a bit harsh. But yeah, we are very different ends of the spectrum on a lot of stuff. So working together, I was a bit like, oh my gosh. And he loves the spreadsheet. And I've discovered that I am very right-brained. I like the floor plans and the new kitchens and that kind of thing. Whereas he's like, spreadsheet, spreadsheet, spreadsheet. And I'm like, oh, bore off. I don't like it. I'll have a scrap of paper and a calculator and I'll be like, yeah, that stacks, that's fine.
Yeah.
So very, very different. And I did worry that it would cause problems because we are such different people.
Has it impacted it at all, your marriage?
No, not really. There's the odd kind of, well, I disagree, kind of tense moment. But I don't know, somehow it just always seems to work. It always seems to come back.
That's interesting. I actually got divorced.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, really? Over property?
Yeah. It was over property.
I was only joking.
Sorry. No, I don't mind it because it's... Again, it's real, it's raw. This is what it is. I actually got divorced through the... This was me and our laser... I'm just like blinkers on, nothing else matters. I actually got divorced over it. I put so much pressure, and it was my fault, but so much pressure on my wife. I'm back with her. I thought, do you know what? Nothing else matters. And it was the same when I bought my debt recovery business. Nothing else matters apart from me buying it because I'm doing it for my kids.
I think that... And I don't mean to offend you here by saying this, but I think that's a very male perspective that you're kind of the caveman and you've got to provide.
I agree.
And I don't mean that.
I don't mean that
offensively at all. But I think there is an element of, as a man, you have the need to provide for your family.
Yeah.
And I know that earning for us is Glenn's biggest priority.
Mm-hmm.
And providing for us is his biggest priority. And I know that without a shadow of a doubt. But obviously, if you are that kind of laser focused and you're not quite seeing everything that's going on around, then that can cause issues. And that, yeah, there are times when, like I say, we'll pull each other up. And there are times when I kind of just go, yeah, okay, I know, I'm wrong, I'm sorry. And I think that's probably the biggest thing, is one of us will realise when the other one's right and we'll just kind of acknowledge it.
Absolutely. I mean, like I say, I got divorced and I thought, do you know what? What a fucking mistake that was. Because I'm not rash with the decision making, but I thought I can do this on my own. Not a chance. Because small things like, although she wouldn't be in the business, my meals would be done, clothes would be ready, small things like that I didn't have to worry about. It would all be done so I could just go and buy a house, whatever it would be. But I took that all for granted. And people don't realise that. If you've got a partner that supports you, I took it all for granted. Not that I do now.
I think sometimes, though, you have to make a mistake to learn from it, don't you?
Oh, 1,000,000%. And that's when people ask me, oh, wow, is that... Like, do you regret it? No. It's a lesson. I learned a huge lesson now because I'll never take that for granted again, ever. because I put her through that. I put my kids through that. Obviously, I went nearly a year without not seeing my kids. I see them all the time, but I was so tunnel visioned. I got what I wanted, and I was that selfish. But they had to be put through that, and it is what it is. But when people ask me, yeah, I did do that.
But I think, to flip that round, you always make the best decision that you make at the time. That is, and I listened to a podcast on it, Assuming Good Intent. And when you look at someone, and the classic example, they said, think of someone that really, really irritates you.
A bit of a few there.
Yeah. But think about them and think about the fact they really irritate you, and then think about they're making the best decisions they can in their life. They're doing the best with what they've got. And that, for me, really turned my perspective on people. Because there's one person in particular who frustrated me, a family member, frustrated me no end on regular occasions. And I was like, why can't you just do it like this? Why can't you just do it like that? And then when I listened to that podcast, and they were like, just think about that. That person is making, no one lives a bad life. Everyone lives the best life that they can live. So if they're doing the best with what they've got, they might not have what you've got, but they're doing the best with what they've got, and they're making the best decision that they can.
Do you believe that?
Yeah, I do. See, Glenn doesn't either. You're very much like Glenn. But this person that I think of, they've got an addiction, and it's driven a massive wedge between us. And when I look at the choices that person has made, they've been fueled by their addiction. But I do believe that they have done what they thought was best at the time. And it's completely transformed my relationship with that person.
Is there not a chain of events that's led up to that addiction? Because I've gone to, give an example, I've been to rehab. But there's been a trail of events that have led up to me going to rehab a long, long time ago. But there's been a chain of events that have led to me up going to that point.
I think there possibly is a chain of events that have led to it. And the person I'm talking to has been through rehab and detox twice and been kicked out of every time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they went there with the intention of being kicked out. I think it's just that they were struggling to cope, and they were doing what they felt they had to do at the time. But I do believe that everyone wants to live their best life. And even if we deem it a bad choice or a selfish choice, it's the best choice that they can make in that situation with what they've got. He doesn't agree at all.
It's not like I disagree. I think people have got different ways of living.
Yeah.
That's
all. But I don't think anyone sets out to live a bad life.
No, I agree with that.
So I think
people could live a better life.
They could if they made different choices.
Yeah.
But I think that's potentially because you and I have perhaps a bit of distance, a bit of perspective, different tools, different attitude.
Yeah.
But where they are and with what they have.
Does that frustrate you? Because this frustrates me. And this is something I struggle with. I don't know if you struggle with it. Looking at someone that's got the ability, but they've got no drive. Like, I'm not intelligent at all, whatsoever. Like, Jesus sees none. But I've got a lot of drive. If I say I'll do something again, I actually gave the family up to go and get what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But someone that's got loads of ability, got loads of Jesus sees, but they've got no drive or ambition, does that frustrate you when you can see it in someone, but they don't want to go and achieve it? They just want to...
I think that would depend on who it is. If it was someone I cared about,
yeah,
I think it probably would frustrate me.
Yeah, the person I'm talking
about, yes, I have been quite frustrated because this person is more intelligent than I am. But I don't think intelligence is everything. Like I say, I think you've got to have the drive and the determination. Yeah, I have been frustrated with them. But again, I think if you look at it from the perspective that with what they've got, that's the best they can do, then you're never going to, like you said, your kids, you can't get your kids to work in the military style that you want to work. I can't even get my 15-year-old to keep her floor tidy. So, but I think it's kind of, I don't know if I'm going to articulate this properly, but it's about respecting that that's what they've got and that's all they can do. And you can't instill that drive and determination into them. You can't instill, you can't make them do it.
No.
So, like the 15-year-old on her floor, she wants her bedroom decorated. And I'm like, you can have it decorated when you can keep your floor tidy for a month. So far, I'm winning. I've not got to pay off new paint. But I just, so to me, that frustrates me because I think, how hard is it? Like, there's hair clips on the floor. Just pick the hair clips up.
Yeah.
Pick the washing up. I've washed it. I've ironed it.
I know that feeling.
Put it away. How hard is it? And they moan when they've got to put the washing away. I'm like, I've washed it, dried it, and ironed it, folded it. What are you complaining about?
Yeah.
But so I guess that kind of thing frustrates me. But again, it's their choice. I can't force her to do it. I've tried, but you can't force someone to do something they don't want to do. So I guess I kind of make peace with that and just think that's your choice.
What's your coping mechanism?
Running
now. I knew you were going to say that.
Running and baking.
Okay.
Yeah.
Baking.
Yeah. I like baking.
So you eat a cake and then run it off.
I don't like eating it. I don't like cake.
What?
I don't like cake.
Wow.
Yeah, no, baking. I like feeding people. I'm a feeder. So feeding people, cooking, baking. and then running. If my head is a mess, if I go for a run, we live on the beach. If I go for a run along the seawall, then I'll come back a much nicer person than I left.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's what saved me, running. But no, I can't really now. But if I need to get
Can you
out.
Cycle or not? Or does that...
With great difficulty, because it puts my hip and my back out.
Okay. I have to cycle like a proper old-fashioned woman because of my back.
Yeah.
If I'm like that, with the handlebars,
yeah,
so I can't move for
That's why
days.
I'm sitting like this now, because obviously my hip, when if I'm like this forward, where my ankle doesn't... Because if you imagine Pingu,
yeah.
It's like... just like that. But they want to fuse this one as well. But cycling, yeah, I'm pretty much like that. So it's more like low intensity stuff.
Old woman's bike.
Yeah, with a basket out. Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. But you make adaptations to everything. You get it. You just get it done. And you just have to get it done. But then, like I say, it comes back to the frustration thing. It doesn't have to be intelligence, like you say. It could be anything. Like, well, if you want to become healthier, do exercise, move more, eat less. It's not fucking hard. Just do it.
Again, I was listening to a podcast the other day while I was running, and it was these two women about body image, and they were talking about body privilege. Mm. And they're both larger women. I think one was a size 20 and I think one was slightly bigger. And they were talking about how you can be healthy. I'm probably going to get shot down for this, but they were talking about how you can be healthy at any size. And I think there is an element that you can be thin and unhealthy. I completely acknowledge that, but I don't necessarily agree that you can be a size 20 and perfectly healthy. I think you are putting your body under stress. I think your heart, your lungs and your joints are all under stress. And again, possibly going to get shot down for it. But if you are moving more than the calories that you're eating, then you're not going to be a size 20. So I would argue, although you can eat a balanced diet and you can eat lots of fruit and vegetables and you can be a size 10 and eat a load of crap, I'm not disregarding that at all, but I don't know how much I believe that you can be a larger size and healthy. I think you've got, if you want to lose weight, then you've got to move more than you're taking in.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I completely agree with it. And that's, I'd come back to the same point of, like with me and the epilepsy, people say to me, well, you should really rest up. Like, you shouldn't do things to the extremes that you do them. Well, I don't. If I don't exercise, the amount of medication I'm on will make me gain weight. So therefore, I have to exercise. That will therefore increase performance in my business. So it's a knock-on effect. It's a snowball effect. It will increase my mental health will suffer if I don't exercise. Mm-hmm. It's a massive snowball effect. And people look at it that way like, oh, I didn't know that. Well, you wouldn't because you're not experiencing it.
No.
And the same thing with yourself. If you don't, especially when you live at home with kids, anyone listening that's got kids, if you don't exercise, if that's your coping mechanism, fucking, I don't know what it is, but tell me. Like, mine, I don't knit. I don't paint. I can't be doing none of that. I need to get out of the house. Most people would be get out of the house and do something. So for me, it's exercising, but I've had to adapt the way that I do it. Like, it used to be powerlifting. Can't do that now.
I so want to have a go at that.
It's brilliant. do it.
So want to
just lift heavy weight and smash stuff around. But I used to be fucking, what was about 23 stone, didn't I?
You used to be a big boy.
I was about 23 stone, but I stripped all the way down to 14.
Okay.
Lost loads of weight. Now I'm back up, but I can strip that back down again. But you're completely right on what you're saying. It's, I was a lot healthier. I was quite unhealthy when I was really thin. But when I was slightly, let's say about 15 stone, I was healthier in myself. I could move more. I was not, it was a lot better. My ankles were a lot healthier. Epilepsy, sleep was a lot better. Business performance was a lot better. Everything was more, but it was better. So for me personally, I completely agree.
I think health and fitness is massively important.
Victoria, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you very much.
I'd love for you to come back on and tell your story again in another couple of months' time.
Yeah.
You helped a lot of people, and please continue doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.